Well, you're right, Red said. Although he didn't have any contractor buddies, at least none that would be paying social calls. Let's go then, Helen told Amanda. Amanda was the one who had gotten in touch with her, and she would be coming along. Even Red had admitted that he could use some help on this. The first apartment was near University Parkway, old but well-kept, with gleaming hardwood floors. The landlord said the kitchen had been remodeled in 2010.
Who did your work?
Red asked. He screwed up his face when he heard the name. The second place was a third-floor walk-up. Red was only slightly winded by the time he reached the top of the stairs, but he didn't argue when Amanda pointed out that this wouldn't be a good long-term proposition. The third place did have an elevator, and it was of an acceptable age, but so many dribs and drabs of belongings were crammed inside that it was hard to get any real sense of it.
I'll be honest, the super said. The previous tenant died. His kids will have his stuff moved out within the next 2 weeks, though, and I'm going to get it cleaned then and give it a fresh coat of paint.
Amanda sent Helen a dispirited glance, and Helen turned the corners of her mouth down. A mole-colored cardigan sagged on the back of a rocker. A mug sat on the cluttered coffee table with a tea bag tag trailing out of it. But Red seemed unfazed. He walked through the living room to the kitchen and said, "Look at this." He had everything arranged so he didn't have to get up from the table once he'd sat down to breakfast. Sure enough, the rickety-looking card table held a toaster, an electric kettle, and a clock radio, all aligned against the wall, with a day-by-day pill organizer in the center where most people would have placed a vase of flowers. In the bedroom, Red said, "There's a TV you can watch from the bed." The TV was the heavy, old-fashioned kind, deeper than it was wide, and it stood on the low bureau across from the foot of the bed.
"Watch the late news and then go straight to sleep," Red noted approvingly,
although no TV had ever been seen in his bedroom on Boughton Road. But maybe that had been Abby's choosing.
"This seems like a real convenient place for a guy making do on his own," Red said.
Amanda said, "Yes, but..." And she and Helen exchanged another glance. "But picture it, minus the furnishings," Helen suggested. "The TV and such will be gone, remember."
"I could put my set there, though," Red said.
"Of course you could, but let's focus on the apartment itself. Do you like the layout? Is it spacious enough? The rooms seem a little small to me. And what about the kitchen?"
"Kitchen is good. Reach across the table, grab your toast straight out of the toaster, take your heart pills, turn on the weather report."
"Yes. The floor is linoleum, did you notice?"
"Hmm? Floor looks fine. I think my folks had a kitchen floor like that in our first house."
And that settled it. As Amanda told the others later, it appeared to be a question of imagination. Red's imagination. He had none. He just seemed glad that someone else had arranged things so he wouldn't need to. Well, it did make things easier for his children, and they could always do some refurbishing after he'd moved in. Helen was going to handle the house sale as well. She came in with them after the apartment tour to discuss the arrangements for that, with Stem and Denny joining in. "Such a comfortable old place this is," she said, looking around the living room. "And of course the porch is a huge draw. It's going to be a pleasure to show." Everyone except Red looked encouraged. Red was gazing toward a nearby newspaper as if he wished he could be reading it. "But it is still a sluggish market," Helen said. "And what I've learned is, buyers in these times expect perfection. We'll want to spruce the place up some."
"Spruce it up," Red said. "What more could they possibly ask for? Every downstairs room but the kitchen's got double pocket doors.
Oh, yes, I love the...
And it's not often you see an entrance hall like ours, two-story, or these open transoms with the hand-sawed fretwork.
But it isn't air-conditioned, Helen said.
Red said, Oh, God, and he slumped in his seat.
These days, Helen said.
Yeah. It won't be so hard, Denny told him. They've got these mini-duct systems now where you won't need to tear up the walls.
Red said,
Who do you think you're talking to? I know all about those systems.
Denny shrugged. Also, Helen said. She cleared her throat. She said, This would be your choice entirely, but you might want to consider his and her master bathrooms.
Red raised his head. He said, Consider what?
I wouldn't bring it up, except you do own a contracting firm, so it wouldn't be such an expense. That master bathroom you have now is gigantic. You could easily divide it in two with a shower stall in between that's accessible from both sides. I just saw the most dazzling shower stall with river pebble flooring and multiple rainmaker nozzles.
Red said, When my father built this house, it had only the one bathroom off the upstairs hall.
Well, that was back in the...
Then he added the downstairs powder room after we moved in, and we thought we were something special.
Yes, you certainly need a...
The master bathroom itself he didn't put in till my sister and I were in high school. What he'd say if he heard about his and hers, I can't even begin to imagine.
It's customary, though, in the finer homes these days, as I'm sure you must have learned in your business.
He himself grew up with just a privy, Red said.
He turned to the others.
I bet you didn't know that about your grandfather, did you?
They did not. They knew next to nothing about their grandfather, in fact.
Well, a privy, Helen said with a laugh. That would be a hard sell. So we'll forget about the his and hers, Red told her. Now, how long do you expect it will take to find a buyer?
Oh, once you've installed the air conditioning and maybe upgraded your kitchen counters.
Kitchen counters?
But then he clamped his lips tightly, as if reminding himself not to be difficult.
It does seem the market started looking up, Helen said. There was a time there when places were languishing for a year or more.
But lately I've been averaging, just 4 to 6 months with our more desirable properties.
In 4 to 6 months it will go to seed, Red told her. You know, it's not good for a house to sit empty. It will molder. It will get all forlorn. It will break my heart.
Amanda said, Oh, Dad, we would never let that happen. We'll come and, I don't know, throw family picnics here or something. Red just gazed at her miserably, his eyes so empty of light that he seemed almost sightless. Be honest, Jeannie said to Amanda. Does any little part of you feel relieved that Mom died so suddenly?
You mean on account of her lapses, Amanda said.
They would only have gotten worse. We can be pretty sure of that.
Whatever they were.
And Dad would be trying to look after her, and so would Nora. And Denny would have thought of some excuse to leave by then. But maybe it was just, a circulation problem or something, and the doctors could have fixed it. That's not very likely, Jeannie said. They were up in Red's bedroom on a rainy Sunday afternoon, packing cartons while the others watched a baseball game downstairs. Both of them wore scruffy clothes, and Amanda's chin was smudged with newspaper ink. All week they had been packing, any free moment they could find. Separate islands of belongings had begun rising here and there in the house as people put in their requests. Abby's craft supplies and her sewing machine in the upstairs hall for Nora,
the good china packed in a barrel in the dining room for Amanda. Red would keep the everyday china, which they were leaving in the cupboard until just before moving day. Color-coded stickers dotted the furniture, a few pieces for Red's apartment, a few more for Stem and Jeannie and Amanda, and the vast majority for the Salvation Army. Jeannie and Amanda dragged a filled carton between them out to the hall, where one of the boys could come get it later. Then Jeannie unfolded another carton and ran tape across the bottom flaps. "If I know Mom," she said, "she'd have refused any surgery anyhow."
"It's true," Amanda said. "Her advance directive basically asked us to put her out on an ice floe if she developed so much as a hangnail."
She was collecting framed photos from the top of Abby's bureau. "I'm going to pack these up for Dad," she told Jeannie.
"Will he have space for them?"
"Oh, maybe not."
She studied the oldest photo, a snapshot of the four of them laughing on the beach, Amanda barely a teenager, and the rest of them still children.
"We look like we were having such a good time," she said.
"We were having a good time."
"Well, yes, but things could get awfully fraught now and then."
"At the funeral," Jeannie said, "Mary Lee Hodges told me, I always used to envy you and that family of yours, the bunch of you out on your porch playing Michigan poker for toothpicks, and your two brothers so tall and good-looking, and that macho red pickup your dad used to drive with the four of you kids rattling around in the rear."
"Mary Lee Hodges was a ninny," Amanda said.
"Goodness, what brought that on?"
"It was hell riding in that truck bed. I doubt it was even legal. And I believe children should have their own rooms. And Mom could be so insensitive, so clueless and obtuse. Like that time she sent Denny for psychological testing and then told all of us his results."
"I don't remember that."
"Supposedly, one of those ink blot thingies showed he'd been disappointed in his early childhood by a woman." "What woman could that have been?" Mom kept asking us. "He didn't know any women."
"I don't remember a thing about it."
"It was pretty clear she loved him best," Amanda said, "even though he drove her crazy."
"You're just saying that because you've got only one child," Jeannie told her.
"Mothers don't love children best. They love them differently is all," Amanda finished for her.
"Yes, yes, I know."
Then she held up a photo of Stem at age 4 or 5.
"Would Nora like this, do you think?"
Jeannie squinted at it. "Put it in her box," she suggested.
"And what do I do with this one of Denny?"
"Does he have a box?"
"He says he doesn't want anything."
"Start a box for him, anyhow.
I bet wherever he lives is nothing but bare walls." "I asked him yesterday," Amanda said, "whether he had let his landlady know that he was coming back, and all he said was, 'We're working on that.'"
"Working on that? What is that supposed to mean?"
"He's so darn secretive," Amanda said. "He pokes and pries into our lives, but then he gets all paranoid when we ask about his."
"I think he's mellowing, though," Jeannie told her. "Maybe losing Mom has done that. When I was taking down the wall of photos in his room, I asked him, 'Should I just chuck these? All those photos of the Daltons, those chunky aunts from the 40s with their shoulder pads and thick stockings.' But Denny said, 'Oh, I don't know. That seems kind of harsh, don't you think?' I said, 'Denny?' I actually knocked on the side of his head with my knuckles. 'Knock, knock,' I said. 'Is that you in there?'"
"Good," Amanda said promptly. "Let's give him these."
And she reached for a sheet of newspaper and started wrapping a photo.
"Denny's getting nicer and Stem is getting crankier," Jeannie said. "And Dad, he's being impossible."
"Oh, well, Dad," Amanda said. "It's like you can't say anything right to him."
She placed the wrapped photo in the carton Jeannie had just set up.
"He's been fretting about the house, so," she said. "How long it will take to sell it. how people might not appreciate it. So I asked him, I said, should we try and get in touch with the Brills?
The Brills, Jeannie repeated.
The original owner, Brills. The ones who had the house built in the first place.
Yes, I know who they are, Amanda, but wouldn't they be dead by now?
Not the sons, I don't imagine. The sons were only in their teens when Dad was a little boy. So I said, what if all these years the sons have been pining over this house and wishing they still lived here? You remember what one of them said when their mother said they were moving?
Aw, Ma, he said.
Well, you would think I'd suggested lighting a match to the place.
What are you thinking? Dad asked me. Where did you get such a damn fool notion as that? Those two spoiled Brill boys are not ever getting their hands on this house. Put it right out of your mind, he said.
I said, well, sorry. Gee, my mistake entirely.
It's grief, Jeannie told her. He's just lost the love of his life, bear in mind.
Which loss are you talking about, Mom or the house?
Well, both, I guess.
Huh, Amanda said. I never heard before that grief makes people bad-tempered.
Some it does, and some it doesn't, Jeannie said.
They had reached that stage of packing where it seemed they'd created more mess than they had cleared out. Several half-filled cartons sat open around the room, the photos in a carton for Denny, blankets in a carton for Red, a mass of Abby's sweaters in a carton for Goodwill. With each sweater there had been a debate. Don't you want to take this? You would look good in this. But after holding it up for a moment, one or the other of them would sigh and let it fall into the carton with the rest. The rug was linty, the floor was strewn with cast-off hangers and dry cleaners' bags, and a hard gray light from the stripped windows gave the room a bleak and uncared-for look.
You should have heard Dad's reaction when I told him he should maybe leave this bed behind and take a single, Amanda said.
Well, I can understand. He wants the bed that he's used to.
You haven't seen his apartment, though. It's dinky.
It's going to feel weird to visit him there, Jeannie said.
Yes. Last night, I had this peculiar moment when I was saying goodbye to him. He asked, don't you want to take some leftovers with you?
Mom's thing to ask.
It'll save you from cooking supper, he said, one of the nights this week.
Oh, Lord. Isn't it strange how life sort of closes up again over a death?
Even the little boys have adjusted, Jeannie said. That's kind of surprising when you think about it. The children figure out so young that people die.
It makes you wonder why we bother accumulating, when we know from earliest childhood how it's all going to end.
Amanda was looking around at the accumulation as she spoke, at the cartons and the stacked pillows and the tied-up bales of old magazines and the lamps with their shades removed. And that was nothing compared with the clutter elsewhere in the house. The towers of faded books teetering on the desk in the sunroom, the rolled carpets in the dining room, the stemware tinkling on the buffet each time the little boys stampeded past. And out on the front porch, waiting to go to the dump, the miscellaneous items that no one on earth wanted, a three-legged porta-crib, a broken stroller, a high chair missing its tray, and a string-handled shopping bag full of cracked plastic toys, with somebody's small, clumsy pottery house perched on top, painted in kindergarten shades of red and green and yellow.
Part 2. What a world, what a world. Chapter 9. It was a beautiful, breezy, yellow and green morning in July of 1959, and Abby Dalton was standing at her front window watching for her ride. She wanted to run out before he could honk his horn. Her mother had a rule that boys should ring the doorbell and step inside the house
and hold a polite conversation before they could carry Abby off. But try telling Dane Quinn that. He wasn't much of a one for small talk. If her mother complained later, Abby would say,
"Oh, didn't you hear him ring?"
Her mother wouldn't quite believe her, but she would probably let it pass. Abby was dressed in the new style she'd come home from college with this spring, a flowery, translucent skirt with a black knit leotard and black nylon stockings, even though the morning was already warming up. The stockings gave her a beatnik look, she hoped. These were her only pair, and when she took them off at the end of the day, she knew she'd find startling black splotches here and there on her legs, where she had colored in the holes with a felt-tip marker. Her long, fair hair was streaked lighter in places from half a summer's worth of sun, and her eyes were heavily outlined with a black Maybelline eyebrow pencil. But her lips were pale, which her mother said just made it seem she had forgotten something. Dane wasn't given to compliments, and that was fine. Abby could understand that. But occasionally, when she slid into his car, he would rest his eyes on her for a moment longer than usual, and she was thinking he might do that this morning. She had taken extra care getting ready, dampening her hair to comb it straight and dabbing a drop of vanilla on the insides of her wrists. Some days it was almond extract or rose water or lemon oil, but today was most definitely a vanilla day, she'd decided. She heard her mother's footsteps crossing the upstairs hall, and she turned. But the footsteps stopped, and her mother said something to Abby's father. He was shaving at the bathroom sink with the door open. It was Sunday, and he'd slept late for him. "Did she remember to—" her mother asked. And then something, something. Abby relaxed and turned back to the window. The Vincents from next door were getting into their Chevy. A good thing they were leaving. Mrs. Vincent was the kind of woman who would have asked Abby's mother, seemingly in innocence, "Now who was that fella I saw Abby tearing out of the house to meet? Young folks nowadays are so informal-like, aren't they?" All Abby had told her mother was that she was hitching a ride with Dane to help set up for Merrick Whitshank's wedding. She had made it sound like a chore, not a date. Although it was a date, in her mind. She and Dane were still at that early stage where even tagging along with him on some humdrum errand, hanging around his edges like a puppy tied outside a grocery store, made her feel especially chosen. So far, Dane and her mother had come face to face only twice, and it hadn't gone well. Her mother just had a tendency to take against people sometimes. She wouldn't say anything outright, but Abby always knew. The Vincents drove away, and a panel truck pounced on their space. Parking was very tight on this block. Almost no one had a garage. What could have been the Daltons' garage, the basement area at street level opening onto the sidewalk, was Abby's father's hardware store. If Dane were to ring the doorbell for her, he would have had to park who knows where and walk from there to her house. So honking was just sensible, really. Her mother was complaining about something in her mild way. "Asked you a dozen times if I've asked once," she was saying. And Abby's father offered some muted response. "Sorry, hon," maybe, or "told you I would get to it." Abby's cat marched purposefully down the stairs, each paw landing plop, 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 as if he were offended. He leapt into the armchair near Abby and curled up and gave a disgusted sniff. Some oppressive quality in the room, its small size or its overstuffed furniture or its dimness compared to the sunlight out on the street, made Abby feel suddenly desperate to get away. Although she loved her home, really, and loved her family, too, and had thought she couldn't wait to finish her freshman year and come back to where she was cherished and made much of and admired. But all this summer she had felt so itchy and impatient. Her father told corny jokes and then laughed louder than his audience. "Ha, ha!"
with his mouth wide open, and her mother had this habit of humming a tiny fragment of some hymn every few minutes or so, just a couple of measures under her breath, after which, presumably, the hymn continued playing silently in her head until a few more notes emerged a moment later. Had she always done that? It would have perked things up if Abby's brother were around, but he was away lifeguarding at a Boy Scout camp in Pennsylvania. Oh, and here came Dane! His two-tone Buick, blue and white, slowed for the stop sign at the corner. Already she could hear the pounding thrum of his radio. She grabbed her purse and tore open the screen door and rushed out lickety-split, so that by the time he'd double-parked in front of the laundromat across the street, she was flying down the stairs at the side of the house, and there was no need for him to honk. His arm was dangling out his window, tanned skin, subtly muscled, glinting with gold hairs, she knew. And his face was turned toward her, but she couldn't read his expression because cars kept passing between them. All of a sudden there was traffic, as if his presence had enlivened the neighborhood. She waited for a driver who made way too much of a production about having to veer around him, and then she darted across, causing another driver to brake and tap his horn. She circled the Buick's front end and opened the passenger door and hopped in with a flounce of her skirt. "Johnny Be Good" was the song that was playing. Chuck Berry, hammering away. She set her purse on the seat between them and turned to meet Dane's gaze. He tossed his cigarette stub out the window and said, "Hey, you." "Hey, you." Last night they had been all over each other, but today they were playing it cool, evidently. He shifted gears and started driving, his left arm still trailing out the window, his right wrist resting casually across the top of the steering wheel. "You look like you're still asleep," Abby told him. In fact, he always looked that way. He kept his eyes so narrowed that it wasn't clear what color they were, and his pale blonde hair was too long and hanging over his face. "I wish I were asleep," he said. "Last thing I wanted to hear was that alarm on a Sunday morning."
"Well, it's nice of you to do this."
"It's not nice, so much as I need the money," he said.
"Oh, they're paying you?"
"What'd you think? I'd be getting up this early out of the goodness of my heart?"
But he just liked to sound tough, was all. He and Red were old friends, and she knew he was glad to help out. Although it was probably true that he was short of cash. A few weeks back, he'd been fired from his job. His family was well off, better off than hers, at least. But lately he'd been taking her on the kind of dates that didn't cost much, eating hamburgers at a drive-in or sitting around with their friends in somebody's parents' rec room or going to a movie. He would watch any movie that was showing, especially westerns and tacky horror shows that made him laugh, though she was less enthusiastic because they couldn't really talk in the movies. Should she offer to pay her own way from now on? But the little she earned from her summer job was meant to pad out her scholarship. And besides, he might be insulted. He was prickly, she had learned. They were leaving Hampton now. The houses grew farther apart. The lawns were bigger and greener. Dane said, "I don't guess I happen to mention that my dad's given me the boot." "The boot?"
"Kicked me out of the house."
"Oh, my goodness."
"I've been staying with my cousin. He's got an apartment on St. Paul." Dane didn't often volunteer any personal details. She grew very still. The radio had switched to "Good Golly, Miss Molly," and Dane's reedy, drawling voice was hard to distinguish from Little Richard's. "I needed to get out of there anyhow," he was saying. "Me and Pop were fighting a lot."
"Oh, what about?"
Dane unhooked his sunglasses from the rearview mirror and set them on his nose. They were the wraparound kind, and she couldn't see his eyes at all now.
"Well," she said finally, "that can happen in families." It wasn't till they were waiting for the light at Roland Avenue that she ventured to break the silence again. "What is it you're helping to do today, anyhow?" she asked him.
"We're cutting up a tree."
"A tree?"
"Yesterday, some of Mr. Whitshank's work crew took it down, and today we're cutting it up. He wants the yard to look good for the wedding."
"But the wedding's at the church, and the reception's someplace downtown."
"Maybe so, but the photographer's coming to the house."
"Oh," she said, still not seeing.
"Mr. Whitshank's got this whole, let's say, image in his head. He told us all about it." "Can that guy ever talk?" "He can talk your ear off." "He wants two photos. He wants Merrick coming down the stairs in her wedding dress with her bridesmaids ringed around the upstairs hall above her. That's the first photo. And then he wants her on the flagstone walk out front, holding her bouquet with her bridesmaids spread in a V behind her. That's the second photo. The photographer's going to stand in the street with a wide-angle lens that takes in the whole house. Except this tulip poplar was smack in the way of the left-hand flank of bridesmaids, and that's why it had to go."
"He's killing a perfectly good poplar tree for the sake of a photograph?"
"He says it was already dying."
"Hmm.
Merrick and her bridesmaids have to get dressed at crack of dawn on her wedding day, because taking those two photos is going to use up so much time," Dane said. "Mrs. Whitshank says he'll make Merrick late for her own wedding."
"And those full-length skirts, they'll get all leafy and twiggy."
"Mr. Whitshank claims they won't. He's laying white carpet down the whole walk, and then extra on the sides near the house where the bridesmaids are going to stand."
Abby looked at Dane with her mouth open. Behind his dark glasses, he gave no hint what he thought of this plan. "I'm surprised Merrick's going along with it," she told him.
"Oh, well, you know Mr. Whitshank," Dane said.
Abby didn't, in fact, know Mr. Whitshank at all. Mrs. Whitshank was the one she was fond of. She had the impression, though, that he was a man of strong opinions. They passed the church where the wedding would take place in 6 more days. People were heading toward it in clusters, perhaps for Sunday school or an early service. The women and girls in pastels and flower-laden hats and white gloves, the men and boys in suits. Abby looked for Merrick, but she didn't see her. It was Dane's church, too, not that he ever seemed to attend. Abby had known Dane, at least by sight, since her early teens, but they hadn't gotten together till this past May, her first week home from college. She'd run into Red Whitshank one evening in the ticket line at the Senator, and he had two of his friends with him, one of them Dane Quinn. And Abby was with two of her friends. It had all worked out very neatly. Possibly Red had been hoping to sit next to her in the theater. It was common knowledge that he had a little crush on her. But she took one glance at Dane, at his forbidding scowl and his defensively hunched shoulders, and then stepped between him and her friend Ruth like the most brazen hussy, as Ruth said teasingly later. Something just came over her. She felt pulled to him. She liked his edginess, his wariness, his obvious grudge against the universe. Not to mention his good looks. Well, everyone knew his story. He'd been a standard-issue Gilman boy who went on to Princeton, like his father and both grandfathers before him. But just this past September, the start of his junior year, his mother had up and left his father and gone to live in Hunt Valley with the man who boarded her quarter horse. And as soon as Dane heard about it, he'd dropped out of school and come home. First, he moped around the house, but eventually, at his father's insistence, he got a job of some sort at Stevenson Savings and Loan. Bertie Stevenson had been his father's college roommate. He never talked about his mother. He iced over at any mention of her, but that just proved to Abby how deeply hurt he must be. Abby had a special fondness for people who tried to hide the damage. He became her newest worthy cause. She flung herself at him, worked to bring him out of himself, zeroed in on him at every gathering, wouldn't take no for an answer. But no was his answer at first. He stood around separate from the others and drank too much and smoked too much and made sullen one-word responses to her most sympathetic remarks. Then one evening, on Red Witchshank's front porch, as it happened, he turned on her almost threateningly and backed her against the wall and said, "I want to know why you keep hanging around me." She could have offered any number of good reasons. She could have said it was because of his obvious unhappiness or her conviction that she could make a difference in his life. But what she said was, "Because of that up-and-down groove between your nose and your upper lip." He said,
"What?"
"Because your hair falls down all shaggy as if you're a little bit crazy." He blinked and took a step back.
"I don't know what you mean," he said.
"You don't have to know what I mean," she told him. And then, completely out of character, she moved toward him and raised her face to him and saw him begin to believe her. Now, it was more or less accepted that they were a couple, although she could tell that their friends were surprised. She didn't explain herself to them. She became, in a way, a little like Dane. She grew cagey and evasive. She began to notice how stodgy their friends were. And although she had assumed, till now, that her ultimate goal in life was a husband and four children and a comfortable house with a yard, all at once she began biting off the words domestic and suburban, with her eyebrows raised and the corners of her mouth turned down. "Who wants to go to the club for dinner?" someone would say, and Dane would say, "Gosh, the club! What an unspeakable thrill!" Everybody would look sideways at Abby, but she would just smile tolerantly and take another sip of her Coke. She was the only one who knew him, she was saying, who divined that he was nowhere near as bad as he pretended to be. Although every now and then, for a flash of a second, she wondered if his badness was precisely what attracted her. Not that he was really bad, but there was something risky about him, something contrary and outrageous. After he was fired, for instance, he had left the building with 24 boxes of staples. 57,600 staples. Later he'd done the math. His glee when he told her this had made her smile. And he didn't even own a stapler. He had once driven out to where his mother was living with Horse Guy, as Dane called him, and duct-taped all the doors shut in the middle of the night. That escapade had made Abby laugh aloud. "Why in the world?" she had asked. But he either couldn't or wouldn't explain. It was almost the only time he had let the word mother cross his lips, and maybe he already regretted it. Also, his drinking, while it was deplorable, lent him a certain shambling, reckless, juvenile delinquent quality that touched her heart even while she was shaking her head over him. You could see this boy coming half a block away and know him by his rolling walk, his hands jammed in his pockets, his face half hidden by his shank of hair, and his back a brooding C-shape. Oh, it wasn't only the disadvantaged who needed compassion. He was leading a life just as hard, in some ways, as the lives of those poor little Negro children she was tutoring this summer. He could shoot a splinter of sadness straight through her. She looked over at his profile, the slant of his cheek below the dark glasses, and sent him a small, warm smile, even though he didn't see it.
"But, so, anyhow, I was saying," he said, lifting his arm to signal a turn, "about my cousin."
"Your cousin," she repeated.
"George, the one I'm staying with."
"Oh, have I met him?"
"No, he's older. He's got a career and all.
He's going away next weekend to visit his girlfriend in Boston.
The Buick tilted slightly as it swerved onto Boughton Road, and Abby grabbed her purse before it could slide off the seat.
"I'll have the place to myself," Dane said. He parked in front of the Whitshanks and took his key from the ignition.
The music stopped short, but he went on sitting there, gazing through the windshield.
"I was thinking you could come over Friday evening. Maybe tell your mom you were spending the night with a friend."
She had foreseen that something like this would arise, sooner or later. It was where they'd been heading all along. It was where she wanted to head. So she couldn't explain what she said next.
"Oh," she said. "I don't know," she said.
He turned and looked at her, although his expression was still a blank behind the dark glasses.
"Don't know what?" he asked her.
"I'm not sure what friend I could tell her, and besides, I might be busy that night. I might have to do something with my parents. I'm not sure."
She wasn't handling this very smoothly. She was cross with herself for sounding so flustered.
"I'll have to see," she told him,
and she yanked open her door and all but fell out of the car in her haste to leave the moment behind. Walking in front of him toward the house, though, she was conscious of her slim waist and the sway of her skirt and the swing of her hair down her back. He must have been thinking about this ahead of time. He must have consciously decided he wanted her and imagined how it would be. The knowledge made her feel mysterious and desirable and grown up. Red Whitshank and another friend of his, Ward Rainey, stood talking with two workmen at the lower edge of the lawn. One of the workmen had a chainsaw, and Red and the other workmen were carrying axes. All around them, in a massive tangle, lay thick branches and cross-sections of trunk. That tulip poplar must have been gigantic, and nowhere near dying, if you judged by all the green leaves. The remainder of the trunk, some 10 feet tall, still towered near the front porch, as flat-topped and perfectly cylindrical as an architectural column.
"Figure when Mitch gets here, he can tell us how much he wants left," Red was saying,
and the man with the chainsaw said,
"Well, I can't see as he'll want any left, because he's not going to haul it out, roots and all, is he? That would leave too big of a hole."
"What? You're thinking he'll bring in a stump grinder?
Seems like that would make more sense."
Abby called, "Hi, everybody." They turned, and Red said,
"Hi, Abby." "Hi, Dane."
"Red," Dane said impassively. Abby had always thought Red's looks didn't go with his name. He should have had red hair and that pinkish skin that went with it. He should have been freckled and doughy. Instead, he was all black and white, lean and lanky, with a boyishly prominent Adam's apple and wrist bones as distinct as cabinet knobs. Today he was wearing a T-shirt that was more holes than fabric, and khakis with dirty knees. He could have been one of his father's workmen.
"These here are Earl and Landis," he was saying. "They're the guys who took this thing down."
Earl and Landis nodded without smiling, and Ward lifted a palm.
"You took it down, just the two of you?" Abby asked the men.
"Nah, Red helped plenty," Earl said. "Only with the muscle power," Red told her. "It was Earl and Landis who knew how not to take everything else with it."
"Laid her in place like a baby," Landis said with satisfaction.
Abby lifted her eyes to study the canopy of leaves above them. So many trees remained that she couldn't detect any change in the filtering of the light. But still, the loss of the poplar seemed a pity. The cross-sections strewn about looked perfectly sound, and the sap filled the air with a scent as vital and sharp as fresh blood. The men had returned to the subject of stump removal. Earl was of the opinion that they ought to just go ahead and cut the last of the trunk level with the ground, while Landa suggested waiting for Mitch.
Meantime, we can strip these branches, he said.
And he set a foot on the nearest branch and gave one of its shoots an experimental tap with his axe.
Abby liked hearing workmen discuss logistics. It made her feel like a small child again, sitting on her father's counter, swinging her feet, and breathing in the smells of metal and machine oil.
Earl yanked the cord of his chainsaw and set up a deafening roar. He lowered the blade to the thickest part of a branch, while Ward bent to grab another branch and haul it out of the way.
"I don't guess you brought an axe,"
Red shouted to Dane. Dane, who was lighting a cigarette, shook out his match and said,
"Now, how would I ever have gotten my hands on an axe?" "I'll fetch another from the basement," Red said.
He propped his own axe against a dogwood.
"Come on, Ab. I'll take you up to the house."
"You're sure I can't do something here?" she asked.
It seemed a shame to go off and leave Dane.
But Red said, "You can help my mom fix lunch, if you like."
"Oh, okay."
Dane cocked an eyebrow at her in a silent goodbye, and then she and Red turned to climb the flagstone walk. Leaving behind the din of the chainsaw, she felt as if her ears had gone numb.
"You really think this will take until lunchtime?" she asked Red.
"Oh, longer than that," he said. "We're lucky if we're done before dark."
She supposed that was just as well. She would have more time to reassemble her composure in front of Dane. By evening, she'd be a whole different person, self-possessed and mature. They arrived at the porch steps, but instead of leaving her there, Red came to a stop.
"Say," he said, "I was wondering, you want a ride to the wedding?"
"I'm not sure I'm going to the wedding," Abby said. She had about decided not to, in fact. The invitation, on paper so thick it had required 2 postage stamps, had come as a surprise. She and Merrick weren't close. Besides, Dane wasn't invited. Merrick barely knew Dane. So Abby had been meaning for weeks now to send her regrets. But Red said,
"You aren't going? Mom was counting on it."
Abby wrinkled her forehead.
"I was, too," he told her. "Because who else will I know in that crowd?"
She said, "Don't you have to be an usher or something?"
"It never even came up," he said.
"Well, thank you, Red. You're nice to offer. I'll let you know if I decide to go, okay?" He hesitated a moment, as if there were more he wanted to say, but then he smiled at her and split off toward the rear of the house. Crossing the porch in 3 long strides, tall and craggy as Abraham Lincoln and dressed not all that differently from Lincoln, Junior Whitshank inclined his head a quarter inch in Abby's direction and then swiftly descended the steps.
"Morning, young lady," he said.
"Good morning, Mr. Whitshank."
"Merrick's not up yet, I don't believe."
"Well, I was looking for Mrs. Whitshank."
"Mrs. Whitshank is in the kitchen."
"Thanks." Mr. Whitshank veered off the flagstone walk toward where the men were working. Abby, gazing after him, wondered where on earth he bought his shirts. They were white, always, and unfashionably high in the collar, so that a tall band of white encased his skinny neck. She often had the feeling that he might be modeling himself after some ideal, some illustrious figure from his past that he had admired. But his narrow black trousers looked empty in the seat, and the Y of his suspenders accentuated the weary, burdened posture of an ordinary laboring man.
"Mitch here yet?"
she heard him call, and a murmur of answers rose above the buzz of the chainsaw like bees humming in a log. Abby climbed the steps, crossed the porch, opened the screen door, and tootled, "Yoo-hoo!" It was something Linny Whitshank would have done. Automatically, Abby seemed to have switched to Mrs. Whitshank's language
and to her tone of voice, thin and fluty.
"Back here," Mrs. Whitshank called from the kitchen.
Abby loved the Whitshanks' house. Even on a hot July day, it was cool and dim, with the ceiling fan revolving high above the center hall and another fan gently stirring in the dining room. A folded tablecloth had been placed at one end of the table, with a clutch of silverware resting on top, waiting to be distributed. She continued through to the kitchen, where Mrs. Whitshank stood at the sink rinsing okra pods. Mrs. Whitshank was slight and frail-looking, but an incongruously deep, low bosom filled out the top of her gingham house dress. Her pale hair hung limply almost to her shoulders. It was a young girl's hairstyle, and her face, when she turned to Abby, seemed young as well, unlined and plain and guileless.
"Hey there," she said, and Abby said, "Hi. Don't you look pretty today?"
"I came to see how I could help," Abby said.
"Oh, honey, you don't want to spoil those nice clothes. Just sit and keep me company."
Abby pulled a chair out from the kitchen table and settled on it. She had learned not to argue with Mrs. Whitshank, who was a force of nature when it came to cooking, and would only find Abby a hindrance.
"How's that tree coming along?" Mrs. Whitshank asked her.
"They're starting to cut up the branches now.
Did you ever hear of such a thing?
Bringing down a whole poplar for the sake of a photograph?" "Photograph," she pronounced it. She had a country way of talking, and unlike her husband, she made no attempt to alter it. "Dane says the tree was already dying, according to Mr. Whitshank," Abby said.
"Oh, sometimes Junior will just get this sort of vision about how he wants things to be," Mrs. Whitshank told her.
She shut off the faucet and wiped her hands on her apron.
"He's already bought frames for the photos. Isn't that something? 2 big frames, wooden. I asked him, I said, 'You going to hang those over the mantel?' He said, 'Lenny May,'" she made her voice go deep and gruff, "said, 'People don't hang family photos in their living rooms.' I said, 'I didn't know that.' Did you know that?"
"My mom's got photos all over the living room," Abby said.
"Well then, see there?"
Mrs. Whitshank took a bottle of milk from the refrigerator and poured some into a bowl.
"I'm fixing okra and sliced tomatoes," she told Abby, "and fried chicken with some of my biscuits. Oh, later on, you might help with the biscuits now that you know how. And peach cobbler for dessert."
"That sounds delicious.
Did Red tell you he would give you a ride to the wedding?"
"He did," Abby said, "but I'm not sure yet if I'm going." She felt embarrassed now about waiting so long to make up her mind. If her mother had known, she would have been horrified. But all Mrs. Whitshank said was, "Oh, I wish you would. I need someone to prop me up." Abby laughed. "Merrick had me buy this yellow dress at Hutzler's," Mrs. Whitshank said. "It makes me look like I've got the jaundice. But Merrick was real set on it. She's like her daddy. She takes these notions." She was spooning cornmeal into a second bowl. Abby said, "I'm just afraid I wouldn't know anybody. Merrick's crowd is all older than me."
"Well, I won't know them either," Mrs. Whitshank said. "It'll be her college friends, mostly. Not many from around here."
"Who all in your family is coming?" Abby asked.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean grandparents? Aunts and uncles?"
"Oh, we don't have any of those," Mrs. Whitshank said.
She didn't sound very regretful about it. Abby waited for her to elaborate, but she was measuring out salt now.
"Well, I told Red I appreciate the offer," Abby said finally. "It's good to know I've got a ride if I need one."
Really, she should just say yes and be done with it. She wasn't sure what was stopping her. It was only half a Saturday, a tiny chunk of her life. the Saturday after she spent the night with Dane. If she spent the night. She imagined how he might say,
"Ah, you don't want to leave me all by myself the morning after we..."
After we... She looked down at her skirt and smoothed it across her knees.
"How's your job going?" Mrs. Whitshank asked her. "You still liking those little colored kids?"
"Oh, I'm loving them." "I hate to think of you going down into that neighborhood, though," Mrs. Whitshank said.
"It's not a bad neighborhood."
"It's a poor neighborhood, isn't it? The people there are poor as dirt, and they'd as lief rob you as look at you. I swear, Abby, sometimes you don't show good sense when it comes to knowing who to be scared of."
"I could never be scared of those people."
Mrs. Whitshank shook her head and dumped the colander of okra onto a cutting board.
"Oh, what a world, what a world," Abby said.
"How's that, honey?"
"That's what the Wicked Witch says in The Wizard of Oz. Did you know that? They're showing a revival downtown, and I went to see it last night with Dane. The witch says, 'I'm melting, melting. Oh, what a world, what a world,' she says."
"I remember the part about 'I'm melting,'" Mrs. Whitshank said. "I took Red and Merrick to see that movie when they were little bitty things."
"Yes, well, and then she talks about what a world. I told Dane afterward, I said, 'I never heard that before. I had no idea she said that.'"
"Me neither," Mrs. Whitshank said.
"In a way, it sounds kind of pitiful."
"Exactly," Abby said.
"All at once, I started feeling sorry for her, you know? I really believe that most people who seem scary are just sad."
"Oh, Abby, Lord preserve you,"
Mrs. Whitshank said with a gentle laugh. Loud, sharp heels clopped down the stairs and through the front hall. The clops crossed the dining room, and Merrick appeared in the kitchen doorway, wearing a red satin kimono and red mules topped with puffs of red feathers. Giant metal curlers encased her head like some sort of spaceman's helmet.
"God, what time is it?" she asked.
She pulled out a chair and sat down next to Abby and took a pack of Kents from her sleeve.
"Good morning, Merrick," Abby said.
"Morning."
"Is that okra?"
"Ick."
"It's for lunch," Mrs. Whitshank told her. "We've got all those men out front who are going to need feeding."
"Only Mom believes it's impolite to make your workmen bring their own sandwiches," Merrick told Abby.
"Abby Dalton, are you wearing hose? Aren't you melting?"
"I'm melting," Abby wailed in a Wicked Witch voice.
And Mrs. Whitshank laughed, but Merrick just looked annoyed. She lit a cigarette and let out a long whoosh of smoke.
"I had the most awful dream," she said. "I dreamed I was driving a little too fast on this winding mountain road, and I missed a curve. I thought, 'Uh-oh, this is going to be bad.' You know that moment when you realize it's just got to happen? I went sailing over the edge of a cliff, and I squeezed my eyes tight shut and braced for the shock. But the funny thing was, I kept sailing. I never landed."
Abby said, "That's a terrible dream." But Mrs. Whitshank went on placidly slicing okra.
"I thought, 'Oh, now I get it,'" Merrick said. "I must already be dead. And then I woke up."
"Was the car a convertible?"
Mrs. Whitshank asked. Merrick paused with her cigarette suspended halfway to her mouth. She said,
"Pardon? The car in your dream, was it a convertible?"
"Well, yes, as a matter of fact."
"If you dream you're in a convertible, it means you're about to make a serious error in judgment," Mrs. Whitshank said.
Merrick sent Abby a look of exaggerated astonishment.
"I wonder what error you could possibly be thinking of," she said. "But if the car is not a convertible,
It would signify you're going to get some sort of promotion.
Well, what a coincidence. I dreamed about a convertible, Merrick said.
And the whole world knows you're